Dr. Julia Garcia is a product of the Texas-Mexico border. She was born in Brownsville, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley to parents who diligently saved $10 at a time to make sure she got a college education. Not only did she get that education, she eventually became the first Mexican-American female to head a U.S. college or university. And while president of the University of Texas at Brownsville, she came to fully appreciate the richness of the region.
We're a little hybrid, and that's not a bad thing. Actually, it's a very good thing because living on the border where the Rio Grande Valley sits between Mexico and the United States and on the Gulf of Mexico, it couldn't be a richer place. It weaves together the richest part of what I believe is to be of both countries and both customs.
Dr. Garcia tells us stories from a childhood in South Texas and shares lessons she learned while heading up a border university, such as how the hiring of one great physics professor in time blossomed to an entire department so strong that she believes it helped convince SpaceX to come to Texas. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. This episode of The Strategist was recorded earlier this year in person at the Bush Center. Welcome to Dr. Julieta Garcia, the first Mexican-American female to head a U.S. college or university. She served as president of the University of Texas at Brownsville for 22 years, was on President Obama's transition team in 2008, and is currently a professor in the Department of Communications at University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. Dr. Garcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Muchísimas gracias. It's a real pleasure.
Vamos a hablar un poco español.
Un poquito.
And our co-host, who I don't know if she speaks Spanish or not, is Anne Wicks.
Un poquito
también.
We'll find out.
Anne is the Anne Kimball Johnson Director of Education Reform at the Bush Institute and is our expert on all things education. Anne, thank you for coming in on this kind of a dreary day and helping us.
Andrew, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Garcia, you have a just fascinating story that began as the daughter. You are the daughter of immigrants. How did your journey begin? What was your early life like before you became this renowned professor?
I grew up in Brownsville. My father was from Monterrey, and he and his family had come to the United States during the Mexican Revolution. My mother was from Harlingen, which is about 30 miles up the road, and had been a pioneer family there. We grew up in crossing the border almost every day, two languages, two cultures. We shared two different moray systems. We could convert pesos to dollars and Fahrenheit to centigrade. And I thought the whole world kind of did that,
right, that
normally.
Normal. Right.
And so I had two brothers and so learned to play and make up and fight boys. That was good training.
That'll come in handy.
For later. Our mother passed away when we were very young. She was 40 years old. And that was before MD Anderson. It was just barely getting started. And of cancer. And so my father gave us great strength at that moment because he said, you've already gone through the hardest thing that any child will ever go through. You've lost your mother and you survived. And so you will survive whatever comes your way because you already have. And now you're stronger and more resilient. And I, you know, now as a mother and a grandmother, in retrospect, it was the wisest thing he could have done. So we grew up, my father says, like little wild Indians, you know, because there was no mother in the house. And he tried everything he could to kind of contain us. But his job, he said, was to push us out of the nest so that when we failed or fell, and he was still around, he could help us. And that's how he saw his mission in life. And so he did. One of my brothers is a nurse, a registered nurse, and owns hospice centers. My other brother is a civil engineer with a master's from UT Austin. And then I went into education and communication.
Well, and I was listening to your TED Talk that you did a while back, and one of the things that you talked about really eloquently was your father's commitment to your education. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
The notion in our home was that everybody was going to go to college. Mother had been salutatorian of her class and not been able to go on to college because of the Depression, but was smart and in both languages. My father, also very smart and did very well. But again, depression and responsibility for other members of his family. So he couldn't go on to college. So you can imagine how horrible it must feel to know you can do it, be prepared, and then for, you know, no fault of your own, not be able to do that. So they had decided that their children would not suffer that. And so from the very young age, our father and mother started a savings account for college. We didn't know what college was, but we knew it was really important because Dad would take us to the savings and loan in those days and deposit $10 a month for my older brother. I came along another $10 every month for me. And then my younger brother got, I think, 15 or 20. So while I was treated differently as a girl in the house, I washed the dishes and the boys washed the car. But when it came to education, there was no difference and expectations were high for all of us. So it was clear that the money that he had was para el colegio. And so if we said, you know, Dad, we only have one restroom in the house, you know, with boys, I wanted another restroom at the very least.
Sure.
And begged, pleaded for that. And I'd say, why don't you take some of that college savings and make a little restroom? And he said, ese dinero no se toca, that money you don't touch. My brother would want a new car. Of course, our cars were 7, 8 years old, whatever came our way. And again, the request was made against the same response would be given. So we learned very early on that there was going to be high expectations. But it wasn't just us, you know, and what's so important is in our family, that's how it was. If the fathers got together, he and his brothers got together for a funeral or a wedding or something, the conversation was always about their children. And it was always about, how is your son doing? Well, let me tell you what my son's doing. So on the way to those reunions, my father would say, give me something to brag about. So we'd have to kind of like think of, so that it was very clear to us that you were to be measured by how well you had taken up the advantage of the opportunity that our parents and brothers and aunts and uncles did not have. So it was a sacred trust.
Did you feel a lot of pressure? Was that, did you feel a burden at all? Or was that not really how you
experienced
it? You know,
there were some nights it felt like a burden for all of us, right?
Yeah.
You go, you know, what if I fail and how can
sure.
I go back home
absolutely.
And not have succeeded at this when, you know, my dad and mom worked so hard. And, but it just, you know, we were just convinced that we were smart enough to do it. Mm-hmm. And, we knew our parents were smart. We did get an Encyclopedia Britannica in our house. And so it was no excuse for not knowing. We didn't have Google, but Dad, anytime you asked a question, right, Dad would say, go look it up.
Yep.
You wanted it. I got it. You go look it up. And so we were in a wonderful environment. We played a lot. But we also studied when needed.
Yeah, I mean that was a major purchase back then. I remember my parents saving up so that I would have access to an encyclopedia. We were a world book family though.
We had ours on top of the piano, and that was look it up.
Look
that
it
was
up.
My dad's favorite thing to say to us.
Yeah,
but it was fun. I mean, that was like you could discover the world flipping.
And then
through
you couldn't
those.
Stop, right?
Yes,
you kept reading and reading.
Yeah.
And then we had one of those huge dictionaries. You know, those the ones in the library.
Mm-hmm. Those need to stand for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And Pan American World Airways had closed down in Brownsville. It had been there for many years. So Dad went and bought a very old stand and the dictionary. I'm sure it's still in my house somewhere.
It sends the message that learning is important. That's the most important thing those things do is it sends that message.
Absolutely.
One of the things in your TED Talk, which Andrew and I both really enjoyed, you talked a lot about the importance of raising your hand. And when I think about your career and the impact you've had and the roles you've taken on, it's very clear where you have done that throughout your career. But could you tell us a little bit about why that's been so important and where you think that came from?
Well, it worked sometimes, it didn't others. And so you have to be prepared for that.
Yes.
You raise
yes.
your hand. So, you know, it's happened to all of us. You see something, you go to a restaurant and they're not serving you appropriately or it's not organized right. And you think, boy, if I were the manager, I'd have this place, you know. And
right.
my husband keeps reminding me, you're not in charge here. Sit down and have a nice meal. But I think there's a sense in some of us that we could do that a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just anxious not for the position and the authority, but just so that you can solve the problem, fix it, make it better, improve it. And so I always felt, and I was must have been a horrible, cynical faculty member, because I would criticize everything, right? I mean, how the meeting was organized, or, and I was young. I didn't know what I, you know.
But you're probably mostly right.
Well, you know, according to me. But. So I remember applying for the presidency of Texas Southmost College, a community college that I had attended just a few years earlier. And I was now a member of the faculty, and I had gotten my doctorate, and I thought I was, you know, God's gift to the Valley. And applied. And I knew I wasn't going to get even a wink of support from anybody. And why I hesitated was not personal. It was for my husband, because it's a small, you know, town. People know everybody. And it's like, what's wrong with his wife, you know, thinking that she can apply for the presidency? And I said, sweetheart, I'm going to apply. I'm not going to get it. But I want you to know why I'm doing it. And I wanted to call attention to the fact that I thought I could do more than what I was being assigned. And I had been teaching the same courses I had always taught. And I thought, are you kidding? I've become this brilliant person and you're not using all of this. So I hope it doesn't sound arrogant. It's just, it's just give me a try at it, because I think I can do something. So sure enough, of course, I didn't get it, but I was in the final list of applicants. So I got interviewed. Well, that process is a good process to experiment with. And it was a horrible interview, but I learned from that too. So, I don't know, so the president was selected, and the president, I think, wisely thought, this gal's going to give me trouble. So he assigned me an administrative job. Yeah. It was the worst job in the world, in retrospect. It was running the steering committee for reaffirmation of accreditation with Southern Association of Colleges and Schools.
That is no small administrative task.
No, and I had no clue what it was. Yeah. So he says, do you think you can do this? And I said, well, of course.
Didn't matter what the question was. The answer was going to be, of course.
So I agreed, and for the next 3 years, organized that process. And borrowed people's credibility, because I had none. I was a baby professor. And so I would find the smartest lady, the smartest gentleman that were professors or doing other things. Someone had run a school. Someone had been a principal. And I borrowed their credibility and borrowed their knowledge and tried to steer us toward discovering what was going on with us against these standards. So by the end of the 3 years, I, every member of the committee, had learned more about the college than we would have ever learned in any other singular position. So I knew how many books there were in the library on English literature and where they were and how, you know, so how many cars were in our fleet and when they had to be turned over. So it was a wonderful preparation. Eventually, I became a dean for 5 years, and then the presidency opened up again. And now I was ready.
This time you were ready.
Yeah.
And I got lucky. There was a couple of women on the board.
Yeah.
And I think the women opened the door.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's such a great story. I think your point on the front end of that about you raise your hand, but be prepared that you might not get it the first try. I always think that's such an important lesson, because sometimes when you're young and you think, wow, I know all the things now, right? It's you have to be prepared for the learning experience. That doesn't mean you shouldn't raise your hand, but just because you raise your hand doesn't mean you're going to get
it. It's the public part of it too,
yeah.
Right? When you don't want to diet but you need to, you say, the moment you say it out loud, now you know people say, well, how's your diet?
Right.
Well, the moment it becomes public, you're measured against what you said you were going to do. So when you apply, then people will say, well, how did it go? And you're faced with, it didn't work out. Yeah. And so that publicness of trying out or raising your hand is hard.
Yes.
And you have to, you know, put on another layer of skin.
Yes.
To be able to survive it.
I think it gets, if you condition yourself to do it, or that it never is like comfortable, but I actually think it's, you won't hyperventilate every time.
Okay. So here's the analogy my husband used. Apparently, if you take a piece of steel and you put it into a fire, like a sword, and you want to make it stronger, you do it by firing it up again, and it becomes more resilient. Well, when I'd be in the middle of some catastrophic moment, my husband would say, you're like the sword in fire, and this is going to be good. You're going to become more resilient. I said, yes, but I'm in the fire. It hurts. It burns. Yeah. And my family is feeling it too, because that's also what happens. But he was right. So just what you say is another way of saying it. You know, those things that challenge you also give you strength. I mean, the death of our mother, you know, living without two parents is difficult. Mm-hmm. Surviving a marriage is tough. Yeah. Working at a job, having children, having all of that together is tough. So you better get ready, because it's not going to get easier. It's going to get harder. So our job, I think, as parents, as presidents or deans, teachers, is to help students toughen up.
Yes.
And then be there when we can't to help them get back up and move on.
I think it's incredibly, incredibly important. That's why I always feel, when I was younger, like most young people, you think, you get kind of bored when you'd have to talk with an older person. You'd be like, you'd be polite. Right. But now I find people are so much more interesting the older they get, because they've actually lived.
They've got stories.
And survived.
And had incredible highs and lows. So now that I'm on the older end of the spectrum, I like to think that I'm very interesting. But I reflect on that all the time. I was just with a group of girlfriends who we have been friends for 30 years, and we were reflecting on things, and people have done big jobs and interesting things, but everyone's experienced very profound, real loss, profound joy, and everything in between. And they're so much more interesting now.
So because you raised that issue, one of the mistakes that I've made is not to keep connected with women friends. And so, because you make a lot of mistakes, right? I mean, you are focused. And there's just so many hours in the day, and you're dealing with the political environment, with the academic environment, with physical environments. So what are you going to call up someone and say, let's go out and have a hot toddy or something?
Right.
That just doesn't fit in.
Right.
And it doesn't fit in for decades. And that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. Now I'm spending as much time as I can reconnecting with primas, with cousins, or with family. With friends, old friends that I've neglected over life. And what's wonderful is that they're gracious and they allow me back in, and we pick up where we were.
Yeah.
So don't lose it.
No,
don't lose those along the way.
I'm always reminded of that. I appreciate you. The additional reminder. Well, one of the things we have listeners who are all over the country, around the world, not all of them Texans, who may have heard about the Rio Grande Valley on the news, or just maybe know of the spring break many years ago. But I always find the Valley is such a complex and compelling place. And how would you describe the Valley and what your favorite parts of the Valley are?
In science, we have interface zones. Mm-hmm. And you know when they say, buy this plant if you lived in this zone?
Oh, sure.
And buy another plant if you live in another. Okay. So we do that with plants. We have zones for animals, too. You'll only find the silver fox in this place. And well, my sense is that the Valley is an interface zone where languages convene, mix, merge, and then separate out if you go into the interior of each country. Where measuring systems or customs do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're a little bit of a hybrid. When I would call us mutants, because plants mutate, right, in an interface zone. Yeah. But people don't like to be called mutants, so hybrid is a better word. So I think we're a little hybrid, and that's not a bad thing. Actually, it's a very good thing, because living on the border where the Rio Grande Valley sits between Mexico and the United States and on the Gulf of Mexico, it couldn't be a richer place. I mean, it weaves together the richest part of what I believe is to be of both countries and both customs. So we grow up living and straddling the border and thinking that the whole world acts that way. But as I've traveled and been able to study other borders, it's very similar to other borders that are international. So instead of thinking about, oh, those poor people down in the valley in the South Texas, I'm always thinking, you just haven't been there yet.
Right.
Because we are at the epicenter, not only of these two countries, but we're at the epicenter of the Americas. Mm-hmm. And so that's where all of South and Central America meets its Northern America partners as well. So if you had to choose a place to be from, I choose this wonderful little place where we're not pure anything, and we're a wonderful amalgamation of many things.
Yes, I recommend a visit if anyone's mm-hmm. looking for a place to go.
Well, and the other thing about that, if I may, and that is that in interface zones in science is where mutations occur, and it's often for survival. Right, because you got to survive in this new zone, and so you got to grow a little bit taller, or mm-hmm. you got to develop a little bit differently if you're a plant or an animal. I think people do that too, and I think we've had to be flexible in how we act. And if I'm doing business in Brownsville, I'm going to act a little differently than if I were in Austin, mm-hmm. or if I'm in Washington or D.C. Washington D.C. or New York City. Because, you know, and I can, mm-hmm. I can adjust all of those. So it gives you a flexibility and of an awareness that's important in a global environment. So we didn't invent the global environment, but I contend that people who grow up in the Valley are well prepared to deal in that.
Yep, that's interesting.
So what does that mean then for the education of those students? So you were president of a university right there in that zone. What kind of challenges did you face, and what kind of opportunities did you see as president?
It's too many opportunities, right, and too many challenges, because it was a high-growth area. It's a very young population, and it's also a very poor population. So often it is on the statistics, MSAs, the metropolitan statistical areas in the United States, the Rio Grande Valley's counties are often the poorest or the second poorest in the United States. So we know a lot of educational attributes are closely linked with socioeconomic level. And I see it in my own children, my grandchildren, because they have what I think are brilliant parents, right? My kids and their partners. And you see it in the grandbabies. They're just miles ahead because of the language, just the languages that occur in their homes. So if a child grows up with a single mom, with very little time to talk to a child, and with very few words in their environment, that child's not going to get to pre-K in the same way that my grandchild did. So that's real, and that has real impact. So that's a challenge, and it's real. But the antithesis of that is that this flexibility that I was talking about and fluidity a moment ago. We have kids in the Rio Grande Valley that are playing chess at 5.5 years old and beating statewide competitions in Texas. And wow. The state's a pretty big deal for chess, and going to nationals and winning. So it is that the Valley in Brownsville, Texas, started kind of this chess infection, is what I call it. And it's infected all the cities in the Valley. So we can have at any one time between 4,000 and 5,000 kids involved, not in football, not in soccer, although they do all of that too, basketball, but in chess. And this is highly competitive chess. Now, if a kid can learn and win at chess nationally and internationally, because they also compete internationally, they can become engineers or physicians Sure. or lawyers or whatever. So there's nothing wrong with the human capital in the Valley. And chess is my argument for that. If there's nothing wrong with the human capital, then it's just an opportunity that's missing. So my job was always to value what skills students came to us with and to say, okay, we're not going to fix you. We're just going to improve you. We're just going to add to mm-hmm. the strengths you bring to this endeavor. And we're going to make you bilingual, bicultural, and biliterate. Many of us are bilingual and we're bicultural, but few of us are biliterate. So that's where the schools come in. If I can help you become literate in both languages and hone those skills really well, then there's no, you know, you can be an engineer, but graduate from A&M or Austin or Brownsville. And if you can do that in two languages, who's going to get hired, the monolingual or the bilingual in a global environment? So now you've turned what people consider a disadvantage into an advantage. And so our my job, with regardless of what position I held at any one time or whoever I was working with, was always to start out with, what do they bring with them? How do they come to us? What do they need for us to help them with opportunities? That's why the PUF Fund was so important, mm-hmm. because this was accessed into the Permanent University Fund. Because if I can't afford to buy you the tennies that I could afford to buy you, and you're both playing in the same basketball game, and somebody else wins, not you, it might be the tennis shoes. It might mm-hmm. be the libraries. It might be the programs they have to offer.
Right.
So opportunity counts.
I love that term, we're going to prove you. I always think, right, talent, intelligence is equally distributed around, you know, all around us. And I think, but opportunity, of course, is sometimes what the limit is. I think one of the things I've been so intrigued about in my time in the Valley is the places where I'm seeing education institutions try to create opportunity. I know that in medicine, and for instance, there's been really interesting partnerships from the business side of the hospitals into higher ed, into some high schools. That's one example, but it's a very interesting openness to partnership that you don't always see in other places. And I'm wondering if you could say why you think that is.
I think you're right, and to observe that. And I think it comes in part because of this need, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. The reason we started the community college and put a university on top of it was so we could share a campus, so we could do a physically smart model that took advantage of the assets and shared them and built a better deal on the other end of it, right? A community university. So necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. And where there are lots of needs, then I think you do get inventive partnerships that grow out of it. I wanted to mention another one that you'll be hearing much more about in the future, and that's physics. Mm. We started physics program on our campus many years ago now because I had this brilliant physicist that we had hired. Well, you got to start out with a good teacher, right?
Right.
Because before then, we did not. We had a 0.5 physicist, 0.5 chemist, right? This one man taught both and that was it. So we got this brilliant physicist from Argentina. And he wrote a grant, and he was able to hire another physicist through the grant. And then they wrote grants, and they hired more physicists. So I hired maybe about four of them.
Wow.
But they built now what is over 24, I think, physicists that are there at the campus. So when I would say that I was going to start this physics program, you know, I'd come to meetings here or in Dallas or in Houston or in Austin, and people would say, like, why? I mean, we've got so many other needs. Why would you do physics? And I'd say, well, because that's where the physicists are and that's where our students are. Well, lo and behold, who would have thought that years and years later, after we developed the programs and we started having great success in the schools, recruiting high school students to the programs and then taking them through their bachelor's degrees there and then off to their master's and then to the Max Planck Institute in Germany for their doctors, SpaceX needs a place to reside.
Wow.
And they were looking at a place that was close to the water, check. They were looking for a place that had a state that would invest in them some capital for installing this facility here. Texas decided to do that. They were looking for a place closest to the equator because apparently when you are shooting up a rocket, there is less fuel used the closer you are to the equator. Who knew?
Physics.
thank you, physics. And so we met that criteria. So the one criteria that was still missing, and then they needed more investment, so we got UT System to ante up, and they did. So the only thing missing was human capital. And you need that in an industry of that kind. So our physics students went to the hearing, the community hearing that SpaceX did to see if this was the right place for them to come. So, you know, it was a chamber of commerce guys and the economic development folks and everybody putting their best foot forward. But they still weren't quite yet convinced. And the last eight speakers in this convening were physics nerds, as I call them lovingly. Our physics guys went over to testify. And it was like, you know, a match made in heaven that the SpaceX guys could speak their language. And they said, "Who are you?" And the physics guys said, "Well, we're physics students from UT Brownsville.
We're your people.
Yes.
Come.
No,
yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
You found us."
And the SpaceX guys said, "What's a UT Brownsville?" I mean, they had no clue, idea, right? So our students said, "You want to see our labs?" Well, we had built this lab that looked like something out of Star Trek and a regular classroom, but they had redone it, and it really was cool. So the SpaceX guys, after the meeting was adjourned, went over to our campus and spent like 3 hours, and then it was super nerd to super nerd. I mean, the rest of us, nobody was in that conversation, and they were talking a different language. So I believe, I always will, that one of the reasons SpaceX finally decided to choose Texas was because we had all those other things going in for us, but we also had the human capital. So you never know, you know, when you talk about economic development for a community, how is that going to change the valley in the future? Who knows? I can't predict it, but I know we're ready. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've got to till the soil before you don't plow the field, before you end up with trees and blooms. And so we'll see how that works out. But they're here,
and
they're starting to do their experiments.
It takes time, but it's the work that you'd put in 20 years ago now that is really coming to fruition. And you'd like to talk about some of those success stories over the years. We were talking before we started recording that you're such a natural on this podcast because you are a podcaster as well with the Next Generation, which is available on Apple iTunes. Tell us about that project a little bit.
Well, one of the things that compels people to do this work is to hear the story of the impact you've had. So you run into a student at the grocery store and they say, "Oh, ma'am, you know, your university helped me do this." Or you're in the hospital and the nurse says, "Oh, if it hadn't been for you."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so you run into your product everywhere if you're lucky. So when I now in this different phase of my career, I wanted to chase those people down and those graduates and find out what they were doing. And I wanted to tell their story. I wanted them to tell their story in their own words, the good, the bad, the hardships, so that that might serve to inspire other students. So that was the intent. Mm-hmm. So I started to escarbadle, you know, to dig around a little bit and find our students. And the stories they're just extraordinary. The young lady who is just finished her PhD in generative medicine at UTMB, and she is growing human lungs. She's part of a team that is
incredible,
trying to generate lungs out of your own DNA so that when you need a lung, we take your DNA and we do some things magic with it. She had to dumb down the explanation so that I
SpaceX guys would probably get it.
Exactly. And so she did. I understood, kind of. And then she said, and then I grow the lung. And right now I said, so where are you in the process? So they're in research still. It'll be still another 8 to 10 years until they can have human trials. Or the young man that started out at our university in biomedical sciences and ended up getting picked up by Harvard to work on his doctorate, full-blown scholarship, plus a stipend, and then got picked up by a venture capitalist firm to be the fellow that would interpret the science. So you're a venture capitalist, you have money, there's a scientist that comes and tries to sell you an idea, but you don't know the science. So his job is to interpret the science to the venture capitalist so that they can decide whether to support this idea or not. I mean, who would have thought that that's what... Now he's done that, learned a lot, got his MBA from Harvard, so no telling what he's going to be doing later on. Or the young lady who became a teacher. And it was her choir who was the first in her school district to ever win state champions.
All right.
And it was the story is just fascinating, but the boys walked out the day before they were going to go to the tournament or the competition, mm-hmm. and the girls left with her, the teacher, choir director, had to decide whether they were going to compete anyway. And they said, of course we are. They competed and they won. Mm. So that's as powerful a story. So you learn a lot from hearing.
It's like President Bush is famous for saying the soft bigotry of low expectations. And it's such a moral disservice, but it's also a disservice to all of us as Americans, as we think about the human capital of this country and what people are capable of doing and leading in big and small ways. But it continued to advance and coming up with sort of miraculous things, whether they're small miracles or big. I'm always struck by that. There's nothing quite like human potential let loose, you know, when you just let people go, which is, it's really a remarkable story about.
And you don't know people's stories, right? Mm-hmm. You get to know them, you shake hands, mm-hmm. you do the business you need to do, but everyone has a story, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
One of our faculty members became the first from Monterrey of Mexico originally, ended up at Rice, and she tells a funny story about learning about this place and thinking, why would they name a university Arroz? Right? We just assume everybody understands
right.
what Rice
She's
is.
Like, should I tell them that's odd? Yeah.
She didn't say a thing. She didn't say a word. Good for her. She gets a scholarship, goes to Arroz University, mm. to Rice, mm-hmm. and with her husband by that time, and he's also an engineer from Mexico. She'd already had a bachelor's degree. She ended up becoming the first Hispanic woman to get a PhD from Rice.
Look at that.
In structural engineering. She is now a faculty member at UTRGV, launching that next generation of engineers. So you never know.
You never know. Doesn't matter if you're from New York or Brownsville. The potential is there. Yeah. Dr. Garcia, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Again, if you want to hear more from Dr. Garcia, the podcast is called Next Generation. It is on Apple iTunes. You can also learn more about it at the UT Rio Grande Valley website. Dr. Garcia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
After this conversation, Dr. Garcia joined a panel discussion at our Future of Texas program for Engage at the Bush Center presented by Highland Capital Management. You can watch that event at www.bushcenter.org/futureoftexas. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review or share it with a friend. And tell us what you thought on social media. Tag us @The Bush Center on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.